Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Today, I'm joined by my friend and confidant, Scott Soares. Hey, Scott, welcome back.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be here.
Well, you're always such a wonderful co-host. I enjoy our conversations. I enjoy our time out of the studio, but you bring such a wealth of knowledge. It's a pleasure that you make the trip in from the western part of the state.
Thanks very much. Beautiful trips these days as it is.
Beautiful trips, yes. Yeah, yeah. Gives you time to get out there and do some leaf blowing before
that. Exactly. That's right. For what still isn't off the trees yet.
That's right.
That's right.
Hey, a little bit about your background, Scott, and then we'll jump into today's conversation. Scott Soares is the former Commissioner of Agriculture in Massachusetts and served as the Director of USDA Rural Development for Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island for the Obama administration. Scott has 15 years of fishery and aquaculture experience prior to that, including early in his career, serving as the first Massachusetts Coordinator of Aquaculture for nearly a decade. Soares has recently returned to these roots, or maybe regained his sea legs. It's that sharp wit, Scott, that brings the listeners back. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. By taking a role as the Mass Shellfish Initiative Coordinator. Again, thanks for joining, Scott. Good
Great
stuff.
Thank you.
Hey, did you watch the Pats game last night?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't miss much. It was tough.
But I heard the radio reports afterwards.
And... yeah, you know, I was going to just say, how could they lose? You know, a loss by the Pats, it's like, don't they know we're title town? Don't they know there are unrealistic expectations prevent them from losing at any point? Well, anyway, I just want to bring it up because we got a lot of Massachusetts listeners, right? We got some interesting.
Still 8-1 isn't a bad.
It's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible. That's okay. Unacceptable. Right. I mean, our expectation, Tom Terrific's got to do better than that, right? Losing by 17. No, of course, yes. It's more of being in title town. We have unrealistic expectations for that, but that's okay. We're going to, you know, move forward with that. Mm-hmm. But it is a connection point for our state and our region, right? Mm-hmm. We bring a lot of interesting folks in. Always Pats fan. It's a great uniting factor. Maybe we all can agree they shouldn't have lost that game. But Scott, I just want to jump in before today's conversation. You do bring such a wealth as co-host and engaging conversations. Your background's wonderful. But today, you actually brought us one of your buddies for today's chat. How about that? That's good stuff. As a guest for episode 93, from the United States House of Representatives, we welcome Congressman Jim McGovern. Mr. McGovern, how are you?
Happy to be with you.
Well, it's wonderful. So you got a week off in between sessions here?
Yeah, we have a week off, but it's not a vacation week. It's a work week here in the district. So, but I'll be honest with you. I'm so happy to be out of Washington. I don't care what I'm doing here. Root canal is fine. So, you know, things are crazy down there. So it's great. It's great to be back here where people are real and where people are decent.
Absolutely. Yeah, I noticed when asked for a sound check, you were asked what you have for breakfast. You said 2 Tylenol and a coffee, and that definitely gave a good chuckle. Of course, right. That makes sense. All right, guys, so I'm going to have you take us back a few years. It was a beautiful fall day about 5 years ago. And Jim, you're standing there ready to officiate a wedding in a beautiful setting up in Vermont, right? And you see this stunning woman, Rebecca, is coming down towards you in the aisle, and you see her there to meet her husband. You look to your left, and there's this guy. He's got all his silver bracelets on, and a big smile, right? And he's got the ponytail, and you look over. You say, whoa, this can't be right. Wait, hold the phone here. Something's wrong here. No. Of course, you guys are good buddies here. So maybe could you share with our listening audience, both you guys, how you met each other and a little more on that wedding day. That'd be fun.
Well, I mean, I've known Scott for many, many years when he was Commissioner of Agriculture, but and also in his role as as the our point person at USDA at the federal level, and I was asked to go on the Agriculture Committee, and I grew up in the city of Worcester. I didn't really know much about farming, and my district, which I had been redistricted, included a lot more rural areas. In fact, I have now 1,800. Farms in my district, but I used to work for Joe Moakley, congressman from Boston, and when I got elected, he said, you know, remember one thing, you don't know everything, and it's okay to ask people, who know more than you do to help guide you. And I reached out to Scott, and he's been a great teacher and a great mentor, and somebody who's always thinking out of the box. But in addition to that, I was given the great honor to marry him and Rebecca at this beautiful place on Lake Champlain.
That's right.
And it was an incredible wedding, an incredible honor for me because, Scott, he did have all the bracelets and all the other stuff that you mentioned, but I could tell that this was a couple that really loved each other, and the people that were there were all fun people, all great people. You had seafood there too. We had oysters, right?
That's right.
I remember the oysters were great. And but it was it was a great thrill for me. I get to do some fun things, but that ranks amongst the top in terms of what was fun to do. And I'm really happy that how many years has it been now?
We just passed our 4-year anniversary.
It's lasted. So yeah. That's something I did that actually worked.
That's right. You'd have to go through the whole election process every 2 years, right? Though, right?
Yeah. So I think it goes back just about a decade now that when Jim and I really first started working together, in large part, as the congressman mentioned, with the expansion of his district up into kind of the northern Pioneer Valley region of western Massachusetts. And as a result of that, although he had always been a strong advocate for greater food access and things like farm to school and getting more food to folks who really need that and recognizing how much benefit that had for folks, is that now he was learning more about where the food originally came from. So not a lot, as Jim mentioned, in the kind of urbanized areas around Worcester, but certainly with the new district that he now was overseeing, that you see some farm operations in that. So he was able to get at kind of the whole picture of food production all the way through to food consumption. And his role from that on the Ag Committee was just key, because the understanding now to connect not only things like conservation programs to nutrition programs was, I know, for the farming community and for those who benefit from the food that we generate here in Massachusetts, it was really critical, for all sides of that equation.
Yeah. Congressman McGovern, I want to come back to some of the local things. As you said, it's great to come visit some of the 1,800 farms you have in your region and just to be back in Massachusetts in the fall. But let's start on a federal level. Let's talk some about this landmark farm bill that happened recently, just signed this year. And some of the iterations in this farm bill, or some of the revisions, there's been, for instance, future farm subsidies tied to modern measures like soil health and responsible farming practices. What's it going to take to move us more in this, to make this the norm in federal policies as compared to the avant-garde?
Well, there's an old saying, it's tough to teach an old dog new tricks, and that holds true with legislation as well. When I first got on the Agriculture Committee, Nancy Pelosi asked me to go on when my district was still primarily urban and suburban, and she wanted me to go on there to fight for the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, used to be known as food stamps, and other nutrition programs. But when I got onto the committee, I realized that there were people on the committee who only want to be on the committee to fight for the sugar beet subsidy or the corn subsidy or whatever. And a lot of the subsidies that they were put on the committee to fight for are really not the best policy. Now, I think the good news is that the farm bills are beginning to evolve into better policy, and that's a good thing, in large part because of the advocacy, and quite frankly, there's a lot more engagement on the farm bills, I think, than in previous times. So soil health, for example, is something that, seems like a no-brainer, but, and now we're trying to incentivize farmers to be cognizant of that. We don't want to use as much fertilizer and pesticides, and we want to be able to grow things in a more sustainable way. And so we're beginning to kind of incentivize that kind of behavior, which is a good thing. It's not quite where we want it to be. We're still subsidizing a lot of crops that I think are not good for us. We should be subsidizing more fruits and vegetables and things like that. But I think we're like at a point where there's real change, and I expect the next farm bill will be much better than this farm bill.
Yeah. I'd heard the farm bill described as basically just this bucket, this big aggregation of a catch-all for everything else. When someone has something that they want to get funded or subsidized, they put it back in the farm bill, and it becomes this huge political football, as we've seen, including SNAP, right?
Right.
Eating up a big portion of that.
But I'll tell you this.
Yeah.
in the last farm bill, the Republicans were in charge of Congress. They actually turned the House Farm Bill into a cruel document. They included all these very awful provisions that, with regard to SNAP, that would have literally resulted in millions and millions of people losing this very modest benefit to be able to put food on the table. The Senate passed a better bill in conference. A lot of the egregious provisions in the House were dropped, which is a good thing. And we had a bill that, you know, that I could support. But we had a bill that rejected all these kind of terrible, draconian, mean provisions. Unfortunately, the president of the United States wants to implement these bad provisions, even though they were rejected by the Congress and were not in the final farm bill. And so I'm now also the chairman of the House Rules Committee, and we do lots of different things. All legislation comes through us, and we decide what can be amended, what cannot be amended. We also kind of set the parameters for the rules of the Congress. And one of the things that I put into the House rules, that if President Trump tries to screw around with people's food benefits and nutrition programs, our House counsel is now authorized to sue him. And so as they move forward trying to undo what the farm bill was all about, we're prepared to bring him to court, need be, to make sure that people don't lose their food benefits.
Would that be about the 30th or 40th open lawsuit against him at this point? Something like that?
It might be. There's a lot to sue him over.
Absolutely.
But I think it's particularly cruel to attack programs that are about making sure that people can put food on their table. You know, we live in the richest country in the history of the world, and we got, you know, tens of millions of people, up close to 40 million people who are food insecure or hungry. I'm ashamed of that as a United States congressman, as a citizen. There are things we can do about it. And, you know, and we waste a great deal of what we grow and produce. 40% of what we grow and produce, we waste. This is crazy. That ought to be a bigger priority in our farm bills and in our policies. We ought to recapture that food. Food that is good, we ought to make sure it gets the people who need it. Food that is bad, we ought to turn it over to digesters and use it for energy. Or something useful, but we shouldn't be wasting it like we do.
It is fascinating, and I think what you're queuing up here, and a lot of what Scott and I talk about, is this idea of systems thinking. And I was alluding to the fact that not often years past, the Farm Bill was around systems thinking. It was kind of isolated or siloed initiatives. But what you're talking about in nutrition or supporting water or food and health and stability and, you know, basically differentiating a lot of these opportunities and connecting them through subsidies to benefit individuals. Gus Schumacher being the namesake right now of Double Bucks and SNAP program.
We both love Gus. We miss him a lot. He was he was another great mentor to both of us. And, I've worked with Gus on programs locally. I also work with Gus when I on a program that is feeding millions and millions of children around the world called the McGovern-Dole International Food for Education Program. George McGovern, former senator, who I worked my way through college in his office. We're not related. You know, he had a good last name. I thought it was a good, you know.
Good place to
people
start.
To this day still tell me I'm a big supporter of your dad's, and they seem shocked when I tell them my dad owns a package store in Worcester. Keep supporting him. In any event, McGovern had this idea that, you know, we have this school lunch program in the United States that has had a very positive impact on kids' ability to learn and get nutrition. Why don't we try to expand this to some of the poorest countries in the world? And Bill Clinton was president, and we had a meeting, and Gus helped arrange the meeting. Myself, George McGovern, Bill Clinton, he assembled almost his entire cabinet, and we began to talk about this idea about an international global school feeding program. And Clinton said, "I like the idea. Why haven't we done it?" And nobody had a good answer. And Gus was working for then Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman, and had queued him up to say, "I've got $300 million that we can put toward a pilot program," which Clinton said, "Great." And that was the beginning of a program we then put into legislation. But as a result of, you know, Gus's inspiration, I mean, we have this program that's feeding millions and millions of kids around the world, getting girls to school. And when girls go to school, they don't have kids at such an early age. You don't have as many kids, so you're dealing with the issue of population control. You know, your kids are becoming literate. You know, the developing world can't develop with an illiterate population. I mean, all these other benefits are there. And so we all have a high regard for Gus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Positive unintended consequences, right, absolutely. When you feed people well. Scott, stepped on your toes, sorry.
No, much like what you referenced, Jim, digesters, you know, as a way to deal with food waste. But at the same time, what we've seen, you know, the crisis that's occurred and still occurring with the dairy industry, that for those dairy operations, it not only becomes manure management opportunity, but it also becomes a way for them to generate yet another crop, energy. You know, it's renewable energy that can be used not only on the farm, but broadly. And I know programs have shifted to allow more of those kinds of things to occur. But right now in the dairy industry, and we can talk a little bit about that, I know we're at this point somewhere around 140 dairy farms left just in Massachusetts. And the decline has been seen, you know, throughout New England, not only in Mass, but even up to the north of us up in Vermont, where we were up for the wedding that we talked about at the beginning of our segment here. And I know that there's a lot of work that's been going on through the Ag Committee and through your work speaking with the dairy farmers here in Massachusetts. And curious if you can comment a little bit more on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been heartbreaking to see so many dairy farms shut down. And we've even seen reports of suicide rates amongst dairy farmers increasing. And, you know, as someone who grew up in the city of Worcester, I've now have this special appreciation for all farmers, but in particular dairy farmers. It's hard work, right? Every day. I remember visiting a dairy farm shortly before Thanksgiving and saying, have a good Thanksgiving. And the farmer said to me, well, I hope so, but, you know, I got to get up at the crack of dawn and, you know, milk the cows like I do every day. And I'm hoping that my machine won't break down, because if it does, then I got to do this and that. And so, hopefully, you know, and I just realized this is a 7-day-a-week job, and it is a lot of work. And, you know, milk prices, you know, have thankfully, I think, are stabilizing a little bit, which is a good thing. You know, we had this in the last farm bill, the Good Dairy Margin Coverage Program, which has helped some of our dairy farmers here, but there's been lots of programs and assistance to help farms in transition, because people can't make it as a dairy farm alone, so they're transitioning into, you know, some growing hops, some putting, you know, breweries on their lots, or going, or, you know, or diversifying what they're doing just in order to be able to make ends meet. And it's been amazing to me that as difficult as it is, and with prices being what they are, that these dairy farmers don't want to stop being dairy farmers. They're trying to do other things to be able to allow them to continue to be dairy farmers. And it's a challenge. And and I was really offended, you know, when I don't know if you remember the remarks of Secretary of Agriculture Perdue, you know, who made some comment about, you know, well, you know, the big survive and the small get out of the business. I mean, I find that so condescending and insulting. Congressman Joe Courtney of Connecticut has organized a letter that we all sent to Perdue, kind of saying, you know, shame on you for, you know, the response of Secretary of Agriculture should be, how do we help you get through this difficult time? How do we help you survive? Because a lot of these farms have been in the families for generations. I mean, there's this history to these farms that we want to respect, but it's tough. I mean, and I know, you know, we've talked about this a lot too. I mean, you know, both at the federal and state level, we need to be doing more.
To add some stats to that point, we were speaking with Sonny Perdue and the concern around only the big will survive. So it was announced just that the U.S. farm income actually will hit $88 billion. It's the highest since 2014. But nearly 40% of that 2019 farm income comes from federal aid. And much of that is tied to disaster assistance or aid for trade wars. And what they also added to this is that Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies are up 24% over the last year at the highest level since 2011. And I think what they're saying, to your point, is you read between the numbers there, and what happens is you have a large payout to the biggest of the farms, but that 24% of bankruptcy increase is coming from the small family farms. So let's skate past all the craziness in D.C. I know, very tough to do, especially after your last Thursday. I understand. But if we have some other leadership in there, what can we do? What would be an interesting new policies to implement to help diversified farm crop operations in New England and abroad? What do you think would be some ways that we could connect some of these dots and get more people producing food that we need?
Well, first of all, we need a 50-state farm policy, and that means that we need to recognize that agriculture is an important part of the economy here in Massachusetts and New England, and that we need to make sure that our federal grant programs, you know, complement what is needed here to help farms in transition. We don't have big mega farms here, right? We have small and medium-sized farms, and there's little room for error. Farmers have to be entrepreneurs. They have to be, you know, public relations people. They have to be farmers. They have to be accountants. Providing, you know, support structure and helping farmers get through their day-to-day, you know, paperwork and simplifying things and assisting them. And we're moving in that direction, providing, you know, grant assistance, you know, for diversification. You know, we've provided federal assistance over the years for things as kind of small as helping you build a farm stand, right, to help get people to come to your farm. You know, we need to go beyond that. And I think we need to rely very much, you know, on our local officials and our local farmers to tell us what is needed, because what is needed in, you know, Kansas may not be particularly helpful in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And what is needed in Massachusetts may not apply, you know, in Kansas. And so this idea that one glove fits all, we have to get away, move away from that and empower some of our local, you know, federal, you know, point people to be able to, mm-hmm. To be able to help fund what works and what is needed. You know, whether it's help with marketing, whether it's help with, you know, building a brewery on your farm, whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. We want to make sure our farms can survive.
Yeah. And I think that's key. I think Jim touched on the point of listening to the ag community, letting them know that they have a voice and they can speak up to let us know, because they're the experts. Farmers love to farm. They know what they're doing farming. The reference to the multi-generational, you know, dairy farms that Jim referenced, those folks know what they're doing. There's no question about it. And at this point, again, with that 140, you know, or less farms left of the dairy side, that's the best of the best. And they've only gotten there because they are the best of the best. Right. But beyond that, you know, getting to how do you, you know, continue to develop the policies, recognizing that these things need to shift over time. I mean, I think, and Jim's comment on things not being the same everywhere, 50-state policy. I know from the rural development side, rurality means something very different in right. Massachusetts than it is in Nevada or Iowa or anywhere in the, you know, Midwest or southwestern part of the U.S. Nonetheless, it's still a critical component when you look especially at the density of a state like Massachusetts to keeping these critical community characteristics that we are all so familiar with. And those businesses that have evolved within those rural communities that need a different kind of support. They're still rural, nonetheless, but they need a different kind of support than rurality in places like Iowa or Nebraska do.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure with your work in rural development, you saw how those more progressive stances are taking place. And in fact, in the intro, Scott, you had mentioned the potential of using digesters, anaerobic digestion on farm as a way of even offsetting, you know, it doesn't have to be another crop, but that also
energy costs, right?
Sort of energy costs. So do you see, Congressman McGovern, at some point in a future farm bill, having something around sequestering carbon? Because what we do, we talk a lot of people about regenerative and this potential of carbon banking into yep. our agricultural lands. Is that something that maybe on
I
the future
do.
Docket?
Yeah. You know, look, you know, I'm one of the sponsors of the Green New Deal with Senator Markey and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, you know, agriculture has to be an important part of that discussion. And we need to have the farmers and ranchers at the table as we're trying to kind of fill in the blanks. You know, we do know that, you know, if we do things like returning, you know, to sustainable agriculture where, you know, we send the animals out to the land rather than, you know, give them feed. I mean, there are benefits there. We know the value of protecting our forests and agroforestry and crop rotation and cover crops and conservation programs. We need to make sure that we're funding the conservation part of the agriculture bill in a robust way. You know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Education on sustainable practices for new farmers. And look, I think it's a challenging moment for agriculture, but it's also kind of an exciting moment because, you know, some of the way we proceed can actually, you know, not only help create sustainable farms, but actually help fight the climate crisis that we're dealing with. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting and exciting things out there, but we need to be having the discussion in Washington. I mean, we have to start talking about, you know, coming together and figuring out how we move forward, and we can't be married to the old ways because the old ways aren't going to work in the long term, and we need to be ahead of the curve. And so I do think that the new farm bill will include a lot of the stuff that will cause more environmentalists to be actively supporting the farm bill. And by the way, to me, farming is about protecting the environment. These farms that go out of business, that shut down, you know, I mean, and where the land is not protected, I mean, you'll take this open space and turn it into a strip mall or into a housing development or mm-hmm. into something that, mm-hmm. You know, is not in keeping with the character of a community, but basically takes away this precious resource that, you know, has been there forever.
Mm-hmm. In fact, our listeners may not know that one of the very, in fact, the very first permanent farmland protection program in the country evolved here. And a credit again to former, you know, Department of Agricultural Resources commissioners like Gus was, mm-hmm. That came up with these ideas that addressed problems here, but could be expanded in a way that helped nationally. So that program evolved into a farm bill program that now allows partnerships between states and the federal government to put permanent farmland protection easements on farmland so that that land will stay in farming in perpetuity. You know, from the day that that check is signed, that allows the farmers to basically cash in to some degree on the development rights to that property. They can then continue to farm that, as well as their generations after them can continue to farm that farmland.
Hmm. Yeah, keeping land in perpetuity. And yep. Scott, as you've said a few times on the show, you don't want the house to be the last crop planted
That's
in
right.
that land, right?
That's right. That's right.
A little more on your background, just so our listening audience has some more appreciation for what you're up to. Jim McGovern is the U.S. Congressman for Massachusetts' 2nd District. His district ranges from Worcester to the Pioneer Valley. In fact, if you look at it on a map, it looks like a saddle laid on top of Massachusetts. In fact, maybe you're holding the reins of the state from that spot. He has a good portion of the Connecticut River that runs through the state of Massachusetts, and thus has a good portion of Massachusetts' remaining dairy and orchard infrastructure, and as you said, about 1,800 farms located in that location. McGovern's district also includes the Quabbin Reservoir, mm-hmm. which is the largest inland body of water in the state, and it happens to also be the supply of Boston and much of the metro area's crystal clear, world-class drinking water, something people take for granted as they
Absolutely.
Turn on the tap, right? And all that, as you mentioned, that preservation of land being what cleans our water, and another space in the near future that will be quickly decommoditized from having no value to being the next oil, right, as
right.
water. So maybe you do hold the reins in your spot. On the Hill, Congressman McGovern is a ranking member of the Subcommittee of Nutrition and the House Committee of Agriculture. Rep. McGovern is also a member of the National Dairy and Cranberry Caucuses, and mostly Jim is an evangelist for food access and nutrition. He's a leading voice in farmland and natural land preservation, and not just in the Commonwealth, but as a large federal programs that impact our country as a whole. And I didn't know, and it was fascinating, about the Green New Deal. Maybe you could share, and I want to take us back to Massachusetts, but where do you see, what kind of adoption are you getting internally? Are there conversations behind the scenes that we can't see where you get some cross-the-aisle support for the Green New Deal?
So, yeah, so there are. I mean, there are some Republicans that I talk with who get it, understand that we have a climate crisis, that science is real, that we got to listen to scientists, and we need to start planning now because we're running out of time. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we have some, like the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, and the President of the United States, I'm sad to say, who are climate change deniers, who tell us that this is, there's nothing to worry about here. And I don't know whether to think that they have come to that conclusion out of ignorance or out of greed or a little bit of both, but they're just wrong. And we don't have a lot of time. I did a town hall at Clark University last night with Senator Markey on this issue. We were having some candid conversations with audience members who are frustrated about the fact that, yeah, we all know what we need to do, but how come we're not doing it? How come the federal government is not wind at the backs of a lot of communities and a lot of states that are moving in a direction toward sustainability, toward dealing with greenhouse, you know, gas emissions, to all this, you know, new innovative stuff? And that if the federal government doesn't get behind us, it's going to be too late. And I think my only response to that is that, you know, if we're at a point now where I think this issue, these issues have to be so paramount that if candidates, I don't care what party they're in, if they're not on board, then they are part of the problem. And if they're part of the problem, they need to go. I mean, we just don't have the luxury to say, we'll deal with this in the next 50 years. We'll start dealing with it in the next 50 years. We got to deal with it now. We should have been dealing with it yesterday. And so, I think there's opportunities for bipartisanship, but unfortunately the leadership on the other side right now is not being very cooperative.
Mm. Well, maybe one of those things that could bring people together across the aisle is if you guys sit down and start talking about more about hemp. Right? Sit down, roll some hemp together, or something could come together. I don't know. Now, let's classify here, because hemp has become an agricultural product, right. And in Massachusetts, it's actually been pretty broadly adopted, right? I mean, we're getting quite a bit of interest here between CBD and the benefits, the health benefits of that, right. But also as just a fiber, right? An incredible fiber here. So could you share with our audience a bit more of, you know, what's going on with hemp on an agricultural level and how we're adopting that in Massachusetts?
Well, and Scott may have a lot more to offer than I do,
sure.
But I mean, but the deal is, as I was saying earlier, I mean, the problem we have with hemp seems like, in Massachusetts, it seems like the opposite of the problem we had with cannabis. Mm-hmm. And that was with cannabis, you know, we had state laws that were moving in one direction, but the federal laws that were not complementing them. In this case, we have the federal laws that are moving, I think, in one direction, but here at the state, there seems to be some, you know, resistance. So it's kind of messy, and so you had a lot of farmers kind of, you know, see what was happening at the federal level and decide to go into this, mm-hmm. and only now to be a little bit frustrated by, you know, where we are here in the state. I'm hoping that will be resolved at some point in the not too distant future. You mentioned the benefits of CBD oil. And I mean, you know, I've had people come and visit me and tell me about it, and I get it. But I think we have a challenge on the state level.
Yeah, no, I agreed 100%. And I think a part of it is the growing pains of this brand new industry. I think what happened, as I mentioned earlier, farmers love to farm. They saw this opportunity coming. It's occurred in other places in the country, and they jumped on board. I think the applications for hemp cultivation here in Massachusetts went from less than a dozen the first year that they piloted it to over 100 the second year. So the problem they now have is that there's a lot of hemp out there, and there's a bottleneck when it comes to the processing and production. That problem was exacerbated, as the congressman said, when there was a prohibition that was put on selling what is really the most valuable part of that product, which would be the CBD infused edible type products that, you know, folks can actually consume and see health benefit from. And I can speak from firsthand knowledge just in my own family, where I have family members that, you know, they may have diabetes or diabetic neuropathy or, you know, different pains from injuries or surgeries earlier in life. And these things work. And why wouldn't they work? The research that's out there demonstrates that we have specific receptors, cannabinoid receptors, that mean that this compound will work for us as anti-inflammatory and as a curative, but it hasn't been embraced by the pharmaceutical companies to any great degree. Hmm. The hope is that we can all kind of stay ahead of that and allow what looked like an opportunity and still may well be for agricultural producers here in places like Massachusetts to take advantage of that and to be a part of this newer industry, a new crop, that they can roll into their diversified portfolio of the things that they grow. Not uncommon. There's dairy farmers, in fact, out in Western Mass that, you know, they've gone as far as they can go with things like anaerobic digesters and robotic milkers and a whole range of things that help not only generate revenue, but also give them an opportunity to generate a different kind of crop, different kind of product. Now they're also diversifying into hemp. And beyond the CBD, diversifying into some of the fiber varieties to look at how we can better use these products that would be kind of a biodegradable, if you would, more environmentally friendly than, you know, plastics that we all heard about. The graduate talk about, the word was plastics back in the mid 60s. Mm. Well, it's not plastics anymore. Now it's hemp, and hemp can be, you know, one of these not only curative but also a kind of broad range product that can be used for any number of manufacturing industries that we once had in places like Worcester, New Bedford, Fall River, around Massachusetts, and the fiber and textiles industries that went away, you know, when the plastics and other textiles industries evolved in other places around the world. So it could really be a great opportunity, and I think still is, in places like Massachusetts.
So we need Gronkowski to come out wearing a hemp jersey with the CBD oil and then signing on a hemp piece of paper for his new contract and a plastic helmet made of hemp, and that's how we really get the word out.
I did notice that Patagonia now has a hemp product. It's hemp jeans or... they wear well. They've done all the tests on them, and they actually wear much better than the cotton or, you know, the heavy cotton duct that they used to use.
Yeah, supposedly the fiber of it is the tensile strength supposed to be unreal, and I think it is, you know, to the point of the processing, right? Because it does anything. There's value processing and everything. So, but fascinating. And Scott, I actually wanted to continue with you on a conversation of another more recent land-based crop that's popped up, and that's from recirculating aquaculture systems, RAS systems for raising fish. And maybe you could cue up, tell our audience a bit about what that is, and what it is, and then maybe Congressman McGovern, you could talk about, you know, does that have a place in the USDA? Can we get to a point where we're talking about raising fish within the USDA?
Yeah, well, I think for a number of reasons, not only including technology development and technology improvement, but challenges to accessing wild harvest product, where back it wasn't even 5 years ago, the value of aquaculture landed edible fish product around the world exceeded the value of wild capture fisheries. So aquaculture is becoming a bigger thing. It's already a big thing in around the world, not as much in Massachusetts or, for that matter, in the U.S., save catfish and maybe in shellfish production. But RAS technology has come around now where they're looking at ways that they can not only better control the environment where the fish grow so they get a better, more optimally grown product, but they can also generate, you know, a new revenue, new jobs, new economic opportunities, especially in rural communities where they need these jobs the most. Mm-hmm. So I think there are real opportunities coming with that as well. It's been a long time coming. When I first started doing the aquaculture work in here in Massachusetts back over 20 years ago, we still had one of the, I think it still is one of the largest recirculating aquaculture systems this side of the Mississippi. And I think, Congressman, we visited that on one of our visits out to Western Mass. And they're getting better and better, and the demand is continuing to increase, primarily because if people continue to eat fish and per capita consumption is continuing to go up in the U.S., they're not going to have any choice but to get it from wild fisheries that are supplemented by farm-raised fish at the same time.
Right.
And although not aquaculture, not RAS related, the value, just to put a fine note on the value of aquaculture products, even here in Massachusetts, although again not recirculating species themselves, right now the third most valuable landed seafood in Massachusetts is a state where we have an image of a codfish hanging in the state house. Is farm-raised oysters, only behind sea scallop and lobster. And the fifth most valuable agricultural crop is also, you know, those same farm-raised oysters. So aquaculture is making a pretty significant mark now, and I think it's in large part, again, technology, but also, you know, consumers wanting more of this high-quality, healthy protein product that they can now get through aquaculture operations.
Yeah, and looking at, I mean, farm-raised oysters actually are nearer to a RAS-based biomimetic system, which, sure, you know, they're investing in ecological systems, they're treating the environment better, whereas a lot of our net pen systems are pretty detrimental to some of the ocean health issues, right? We look at some of that. So this is a next iteration. So if you are an environmentalist and you are voting with your dollar three times a day for your food, boy, some of these better systems we can start to look at, you know, using our better appropriation of resources and land-based systems for raising fish, salmon being a good example of that, and new systems coming out everywhere.
Exactly.
Systems, yeah. Exactly. Do you feel that there is some potential for the USDA to start to look at this and spawn new proliferation?
Pun intended.
Yeah. Well, there's so many puns in the
office. Yeah, yes, I do. I do. And there's some limited grant money available for aquaculture and the farm bill, but I mean, I think it as time goes on and as you know, people begin to realize the potential, not only in terms of the economy, but also in terms of the health and well-being of our citizenry, because eating fish is a good thing, and you know, I think you're going to see more and more attempts to, you know, to provide support for this industry. Look, you know, I always tell people that intelligence is not a prerequisite for serving in Congress. And there are a lot of people in Congress who know a lot about a few things, but know nothing about a lot of things. And in order to correct that, we just need to be more aggressive in telling the success stories and sharing what the potential is. And I think, you know, as we said in the beginning, I mean, the Farm Bill is becoming more and more, I would say, I use the word progressive, in terms of acknowledging the realities of the climate crisis, but also in investing more in terms of fresh fruits and vegetables than ever before. You know, it didn't just happen. It's happening because people are being lobbied by their constituents to do that. They're also watching the market forces. You know, people are buying, you know, products from fish from produced in aquaculture. People want more fresh fruits and vegetables. They want more, you know, organic crops. They want more, you know, grass-fed meats. I mean, they're demanding this, and so, you know, they're going to stores and purposely making choices that are moving us in a direction which I think is a good and healthy direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
When I had Congresswoman Pingree on, I asked her, you know, as a final question, I'll ask you the same. I asked her, what can we do? Listeners, we have listeners all over the world, actually, that listen to this, but we have a lot from the States. What can we do to make this a better future? Sure, we can vote in a better appropriation. We can spend our dollars appropriately on good food. One thing she brought up, what I found interesting, is build businesses around this. Building successful business around this, that gives me arsenal to go down to D.C., sit on the Hill, and say, here's your proof case. We can do this in other spots. What would you share with our listening audience on how to grow some of the things we've been talking about today and really start focus on the systems-based approach?
Well, you know, I have great admiration for Congresswoman Pingree. We work very closely together on a number of agricultural-related issues. But she's right. I mean, success breeds success. You know, members of Congress like to be associated with success stories. I mean, there's businesses being built that are making money, that are employing people, you know, and that are doing other good things for our community. You know, we want to be associated with all things good. We want everyone to feel good about us when we talk about the things that we're advocating for. So that's one thing. Voting is still important. When we vote for people who deny that we have a climate crisis, when we vote for people who say things like, you know, the big survive and the small, well, the hell with you. I'm kind of paraphrasing here. Then you're going to get that, right? I mean, you're not going to get the progress that you want. And the other thing is, we got to talk about these issues more. And I think, you know, this is great. I appreciate this podcast, but Scott's been wonderful because, I do these farm tours every year, he oftentimes tags along with me because I don't know everything. Sometimes the farmers don't know all that is out there, and we need creative thinkers to be thinking out of the box, helping us get to where we want to go. So it's, you know, activism, there's no substitute for activism. And we can think big thoughts all we want, but unless we do them and unless we fight for them, then they're just, you know, they're our thoughts. So I agree with Congresswoman Pingree, but I'm also a big believer that we have to make sure we participate in the political process, not only at the federal level but at the state and local level, because they're every bit as important. Mm-hmm. Some of the biggest challenges we have are at the state level, plus dealing with, you know, localities that are fighting over X, Y, or Z. I mean, we need to be better at every level. The final thing I want to say is that I am a huge advocate of our local farmers, and I make it a point as much as I can to make sure I buy everything that is produced here locally. It doesn't mean I have anything against, you know, New York or Kansas or Michigan. I mean, I see how hard these farmers work, and agriculture is an important part of our economy. In fact, Our Office of Tourism is even promoting agritourism, so there's even another benefit there. These farmers deserve our support, and so when we go shopping, for those who are not in this field, you ought to make it a point to buy locally.
Mm. Great insight, great advice. I thank you. Scott, I'm going to give you a chance to have final thoughts here.
Sure. Well, I've seen it firsthand, and I think Congressman McGovern prescribes the same line of thinking that I do, that if you don't work as hard as those you're representing, then you're not doing your job. And I think we're really fortunate to have someone like Jim there in Congress representing just this, not only the 2nd District, but all farms in Massachusetts and folks who are trying to access better, healthier diets and jobs associated with all of that. So it's a real privilege to have you here with us. And I'm really happy to call you my friend. So
You're my friend and my teacher, and he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of agriculture, in my opinion.
Thanks, Jim.
But younger.
That's good. Very good. That's good stuff. I'll close by saying that, you know, maybe more of city folks should be paying attention to what's going on in rural environments, what's happening outside of the 495 loop here in the Boston area, right? And we got small things coming at us like our healthy food, clean water, fresh air. This is where it all comes from. And as we've heard today, this is the future scope. This is where we need to be better connected with folks like yourself, Congressman McGovern, that are fighting this battle on the Hill, are essential. And then sharing that message is surely welcome. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share this wisdom with our listening audience. I learned a great deal. And Scott, I know you guys are good buddies.
Always.
So you always. But thank you so much for
taking
the
time. Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it.